to be clear, I'm not trying to say companies should not engage in customer incentive programs. They can be very powerful tools in driving sales. Goodness knows my choice of airline is driven largely in part because of my participation in a frequent flyer program. But managers should not fool themselves into thinking that this is loyalty. Loyalty is different than incentivized sales. It is a potential source of value for companies, and they should give careful consideration to how much it is worth to them to cultivate a more loyal customer base. So, how do we build customer loyalty and not just facilitate customer habit? The clearest path is by remembering all four sources of customer value and by providing varied and substantial value to customers. There are people who drink Coke because it is what they have always drunk and it is nearly always available. Then there are those who see themselves as Coke people. They use the brand as a badge, deriving social and psychological benefits from it. The first group is merely acting out of habit. But customers who derive multiple types of value from an offering are much more likely to be really loyal to the brand. Loyalty is also derived from interactions with the brand that feel more like interactions with a friend than with an economic exchange partner. Friends look out for each other's best interests. They do each other favors. They understand each other's needs. Brands that want to foster loyalty should look to create opportunities for creating communal sharing relationships with their customers. Okay, let's move from loyalty value to a second type of value that customers can provide to companies: information value. Your customers can provide you with vast amounts of valuable information if only you will listen to them. This information comes in several flavors. One type of information is information about the customers themselves. Simply by collecting data on customer purchases, companies can find out all kinds of interesting things. Using just purchase data, the retail giant Target can tell whether one of their customers is pregnant. Seriously. Weeks before she's even showing, and months before she starts buying anything obvious like diapers. Sometimes Target knows even before the woman's own family is aware of the impending bundle of joy. And armed with this information, Target can reach out to those customers with appeals designed specifically to meet their needs. So, if Target can determine with a certain probability that someone in a particular household is probably expecting, they can start to send out flyers and coupons and catalogs to that address, featuring all the things that person will need over the coming months: maternity clothes, cribs, strollers, baby food, and diapers. Oh, so many diapers. Just imagine how much more efficient it is to deliver messages that your customers are actually interested in. Instead of broadcasting information about your great deals on baby wipes to everyone in the hopes of reaching the small percentage of customers who will actually care, you can find out what customers like by observing their behavior. So, your customers can provide you with valuable information about themselves if you collect it and pay attention to it and use it properly. You can use this information to better customize your offerings, to develop new offerings, and to make accurate forecasts. But it's not limited to sales data, requests for information, navigation patterns through your store or through a website. All of this information can teach you something about your customers. This information should be considered as a potential source of value that your customers can provide, over and above the money that they give you in an exchange. A second way that customers can provide information that is of value to you is as an asset that can be sold to other companies. Insights about your customers can often be valuable to other companies. But I'd like to focus on a third, often overlooked type of information that customers can provide. And that's information about you, about your operations and your marketing, about your business and how well it's working. In my MBA classes, I teach a case about a product failure. The students read a fictional letter of complaint from a dissatisfied customer, along with a response letter from someone in management describing the company's version of events. After a wide-ranging debate on the various considerations that are important when dealing with unhappy customers, I asked the students to generate a list of all the things that we learned from that letter about our own operations. In this hypothetical scenario, the list is substantial. There was a process failure. There were communications failures. There were inadequate policies and procedures that this customer's complaint uncovered for us. Now, how much credence should you give one customer complaint? Maybe it was just one cranky person who would have complained about anything. Yes, maybe. But a more conservative way of looking at it is to realize that actually going to management to complain about something takes effort. Many customers will not find it worth their time. It's wise to consider applying a multiplier to any customer complaints you receive. How much of a multiplier? Well, that will depend on the types of customers you serve and the types of offerings you sell. But whatever the exact multiplier is, it's almost certainly greater than one. In almost every industry, you will not hear about every single product or service failure that your customers endure. So it's good policy to assume that every customer bringing you information, both positive and negative, is speaking on behalf of several others. So I ask my students, do you think this type of information would be valuable to you if you were running this company? There's general agreement that yes, in fact, this would be valuable information to have. And then I ask, how much do you think you would need to pay a consultant to go out and gather this information for you? That question usually draws a surprised silence. Because the fact is, you could hire a consultant to go out and audit your processes and your procedures and to tell you how you could improve. And there are many consulting firms that would do a fine job and would give you some great insights. They would also charge you a substantial amount of money to do that work. Or you could get many of these insights for almost nothing by simply opening your ears and listening to your customers, both the happy ones and the unhappy ones. They will often have great information about how to run your company. Use your customers as consultants. The best example I have heard of a company using their customers as consultants is Stu Leonard's. Stu Leonard's is a grocery store and dairy. But if you talk to someone from the Northeast who's actually been there, they will probably have a hard time describing it to you. Grocery store just doesn't seem to cover it. They only sell 2,200 items, as compared to a typical grocery store which sells 45,000 or more. The New York Times called Stu Leonard's the Disneyland of dairy stores. There are people in costumes to entertain the kids. There's an animatronic robot that sings and dances. Some locations even feature petting zoos. But what really makes Stu Leonard's unique is the process that they use to come up with all these crazy ideas that they implement on the sales floor. Every store contains an oversized suggestion box, which is crammed full of customer feedback every day. Many stores have suggestion boxes. These are nice, safe, warm places where customer feedback can stay unmarred by human hands until time ends. Customers know this, and so they never bother to actually use the suggestion boxes, except as places perhaps to leave their old chewing gum. But customers take the time to leave suggestions at Stu Leonard's, lots of suggestions, because this store actually does something about it. Every day, before the store opens, someone is assigned to empty the suggestion box, type up every suggestion, and circulate it to all the various departments around the store. Before lunch, every day, everyone has a list of all the things that need working on, as well as a healthy list of things that customers currently love about the store. Was the tuna salad from the deli too soupy? Were the floors dirty? Now all of the store's employees know. Suggestions come for new products to stock, new flavors to carry. It's an endless list of ways to improve the business, provided for free every day the store is open. Stu Leonard's also holds regular focus groups with their customers. They just ask them, what would they like to see the store do differently? One customer suggested they start selling fresh fish instead of the packaged fish that the grocery store currently carried. This customer liked buying her fish fresh off the ice instead of wrapped in styrofoam and cellophane. It hadn't occurred to them that customers would care. It's the same fish, after all. But they tried it. They opened a fresh fish bar next to the refrigerated packaged fish, and sales doubled. The sales of the packaged fish didn't decline, but there was apparently a large, underserved market of people who were more interested in buying fish fresh off the ice and carved to specification. How well has this philosophy of listening to the customer served Stu Leonard's? Well, it is in the Guinness Book of World Records as having the greatest sales per unit area of any single food store in the United States. It has also enjoyed a consistent spot on Forbes' list of the top 100 businesses to work for. Information value is an untapped resource for many firms, just waiting to be harnessed. The third source of company value that we'll talk about today is communication value. This is the value that customers bring to you by talking to other potential customers about your business. In short, customer word of mouth. We'll talk a lot more about how to generate word of mouth in a subsequent lecture. For now, I just want to emphasize the value customer communications can provide to the company. Most of the sources of value we will talk about today are strictly positive. You may be able to get a lot or a little out of a particular type of value, but rarely do you need to worry about negative value. Communication value stands in sharp contrast, where it can be tremendously helpful when your customers tell their friends and neighbors how great you are. There's also tremendous harm that can come from negative word of mouth. Communication value is difficult to account for because it is so difficult to measure directly. Even though it's hard to know exactly how much word of mouth is affecting your customers, it's relatively easy to figure out, in general terms, how important word of mouth is likely to be for your company. You can start by asking yourself some general questions about the type of market you are competing in and also the type of customers you're serving. When determining how important communication value is to your company, you should first determine the structure of the market in which you're competing. Is this a competitive market? Are there lots of alternatives for your customers to choose from? If it is, then the opinions of other customers, both good and bad, are likely to have a significant impact on your revenue. Also, what kinds of goods or services do you sell? Some types of purchases people are just more likely to talk to their friends about, and people are more likely to seek out the opinion of others before buying those options for themselves. For example, most people will do a lot of research before purchasing big ticket items, and often that research will involve talking to other people. Likewise, goods and services whose quality is difficult to assess beforehand are especially susceptible to the effects of word-of-mouth communications. So, customers might be especially likely to seek out opinions of friends and relatives when selecting pediatricians and mechanics and contractors. Next, ask yourself about the customers you serve. Some customers are especially likely to influence others with their opinions. This would include people with large social networks, those who are leaders in their communities, and those who are articulate or skilled in communications. Now, you may serve a target group of customers who are especially likely to include high or low percentages of customers with those characteristics. Do you sell high-end luxury cars? Well, then you probably sell to a lot of people who can influence others. Do you sell to teenagers? Well, then you probably have a lot of customers with very large social networks. If your target market doesn't seem likely to contain a disproportionate share of influencers, you should still take time to consider the size of your overall target segments. Because in a large enough group of customers, some of them are going to have the skills and motivation to influence others. If those persuasive customers have an especially good experience, great. On the other hand, if you just happen to disappoint someone with a large social network who is articulate and, heaven forbid, funny, well, you're not going to have a good time. Which brings us to the final set of questions you should ask when trying to determine how important word of mouth will be to your business. Ask yourself about the types of experiences your customers are likely to have with your offerings, both the good and the bad experiences. How typical are those experiences going to be? How easy will it be for others to identify with and sympathize with the customer who had that especially good or bad experience? Let me give you an example. In 2008, a Canadian musician named Dave Carroll was flying to a gig. While waiting for a United Airlines plane to take off, he overheard some passengers talking about how the baggage handlers were throwing around some guitars on the tarmac. In a panic, Dave looked out his window and saw that his $3,500 guitar was being badly abused during the loading process. He immediately alerted the cabin crew, but they didn't do anything about it. When Dave got to his final destination, he retrieved his guitar, and sure enough, the guitar was broken. The neck of the guitar had been snapped in two. Dave sought redress from United, but after 9 months of giving him the runaround, they ultimately denied his claim on the grounds that he had filed too late, outside of the 24-hour window United allowed for such claims. So, let's go back through our list of questions and figure out how bad this could get for United. First, is United competing in a crowded market? One that provides customers with lots of alternatives and low switching costs. Yes, very much so. Okay, so that's not good for United so far. It suggests that word of mouth could be important. Do people seek out opinions of others when buying airline tickets? Maybe. Probably not as much as some other consumer goods. Finally, how typical is this experience? In other words, how easy would it be for other customers to hear about this experience and picture it happening to them? How hard would it be for you to imagine airlines damaging your luggage? Yeah, that's what I thought. Now, United would have no way of knowing beforehand whether this particular customer was articulate and clever or whether he had a large social network. But United serves millions of customers each year, which means they also serve thousands or tens of thousands of customers who are skilled communicators and who have large networks with whom they can communicate. Thousands of those influencers are out there potentially making things better or worse for United. As it happens, Dave Carroll is not just a talented musician. He's also hilarious. He wrote a clever little song called United Breaks Guitars, detailing his miserable customer experience. He and his band then put together a video for the song and threw it up on YouTube. If you've got a few minutes, it's really worth tracking down and watching. The same day they posted it on YouTube, it had more than 150,000 views. Within a month, it had been seen more than 5 million times. Within 6 months, 10 million. And that's just YouTube. Once this thing started taking off, mainstream news outlets started reporting on it. CNN did a story on the song's popularity. Yeah, ouch. This was kind of a public relations disaster for United, and it's important to note the damage was not done by breaking the guitar, but by the policies United had implemented to protect itself from paying out too much in claims. United had privileged direct or monetary value over communications value, and they almost certainly cost themselves more than they had gained from that stringent policy. When companies think of the value they want to get out of an exchange with customers, revenue and profit naturally top the list. And while direct monetary value is usually the most important source of value for the company, it's not the only source of value. Companies also need to consider the potential importance of loyalty value, information value, and communication value. In fact, those various sources of value are so important, we're going to put them in our marketing toolbox. This tool is easy, just a list of the four sources of value. But they're important to remember when considering how to value your customers. The four types of value a company can derive from its customers are direct value, loyalty value, information value, and communication value. And with that, we've actually reached the end of the strategy section of our course. We've discussed the major ideas for creating a marketing strategy, of answering those questions. Who is my customer? What do they value? And how can I give them what they value better than the competition? Now that we have our strategy sketched out, it's time to start thinking about the tactics we will use to reach our strategic goals. And that's what the rest of the course will be about.
This lecture is titled, Creating Great Customer Experiences.
The course up to this point has been focused on marketing strategy, answering those three all-important marketing questions. Who are my customers? What do they value? And how can I give them what they value better than the competition? The way we answer those questions is through the process of segmentation, targeting, and positioning, and also by fully accounting for the various sources of value that customers and companies can get from an interaction. These are all strategic concerns, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the course, the strategy must come first. But once you have your strategy, you must then successfully implement it. This is what we'll talk about for most of the remainder of the course, the marketing tactics you can use to implement your marketing strategy. The most famous framework for remembering all the marketing tactics that you have at your disposal is called the four P's: product, price, promotion, and place. Product refers to the offering itself. What are the attributes of your product or service? In this context, product also includes things like branding, packaging, and warranties. Price is pretty straightforward. But in the four P's, price would also include things like temporary discounts, sales, coupons. It can also include non-monetary costs to the consumer, things like time, energy, and attention. So, if your customer has to travel some distance in order to buy your product, that would be considered a cost to the customer. So, you would generally consider it under the price heading. Promotion refers to all non-price ways of incentivizing purchase. This would include advertising, sponsorships, salespeople, so on. Finally, place is distribution. How does the product get to the customer? Where can the customer buy the offering? This can include virtual places like websites. The four P's were developed as a tactical framework by marketing professor Edmund McCarthy way back in 1960, and it's served marketers well since then. As I will explain shortly, I favor a slightly different framework when I'm teaching tactical marketing, but the 4P model works just fine for those who use it correctly. Let me offer, though, two words of warning about the 4Ps. First, because of its popularity in history, some people have come to treat the 4Ps as if they encompass everything you need to know about how to solve marketing problems. This is simply not true. Remember, the 4Ps is a tactical framework. You need a strategy before you can hope to implement the 4Ps well. If you ever find yourself in a meeting where you're discussing a new product launch and someone starts off the conversation by asking, "So, how are we going to price this?" Or, "How should we design this product?" Or, "How are we going to promote this?" Well, then you need to pound your fists on the table and say, "No, this shall not stand. Don't you dare invoke the 4Ps before we know who our customers are and what they value." Sure, it's a little dramatic, but it gets the point across. Remember, strategy always comes first. That's very important. The second danger in using the four P's is remembering that this framework also includes everything behind those four P words. A framework like this is useful because it reminds you of all the different decisions that need to be made in order for an offering to be successful. That means if you're going to use the four P's correctly, it's not enough just to remember what those P's stand for. You must also remember all the non-P's that are included in those four broad categories of product, price, promotion, and place. So, for example, you must remember that product includes services and branding. Promotions includes all the different ways you can communicate with your customers. If you don't remember all those individual decisions that need to be made, well, then the framework hasn't done you actually any good. For those reasons, I prefer a slightly expanded tactical model based on the marketing mix framework developed by Alexander Chernev in his book Strategic Marketing Management. This framework includes seven basic classes of decisions that marketers must make about the offering they're selling: product, service, brand, price, promotions, communication, and distribution. Taken together, we refer to these seven variables as the marketing mix. There's obviously quite a bit of overlap between the four P's and the marketing mix. That's okay. In fact, it's intentional. The advantage of a somewhat expanded list of marketing mix variables is that A, we won't accidentally forget anything important like, say, branding, and B, we're not pigeonholed into using words that start with P instead of more accurate, more descriptive, more intuitive words that start with another letter, like distribution instead of place. Over the next several lectures, we'll tackle the major tactical decisions marketers need to make. But today, we're going to focus on just the first two, product and service. Taken together, these two variables are most descriptive of the offering itself, what it is we're trying to sell. Our earlier lecture on positioning identified a process for determining what attributes to include in your product or service. Positioning should always be the primary driver of your decisions. What do my customers want in this product or service? How can I design this product or service to give them what they want in a way that is sustainably differentiated from competitors' offerings? So with the understanding that how we position our product or service is the most important consideration when determining these two marketing mix variables, let's address some additional issues. There are a few different approaches to making tactical decisions about your products and services. In this lecture, I'm going to focus on an approach that's become very popular: designing your products and services to provide the best possible experience for your customer. The basic idea is that customers' evaluations of products are really evaluations of their experiences with the products, how it feels to buy, use, and consume them. Products and services are different in some very important ways. Products tend to be tangible and separable from production, for example, whereas services tend to be intangible and consumed at the same time they're created. But by focusing on the customer experience, we actually blur those differences. From a customer experience standpoint, it doesn't matter so much whether it's a product or a service. What matters is what the customer thinks and feels during the interaction. In essence, a focus on customer experience means treating everything like a service. So, if we are going to design products and services around the customer experience, it's important for us to understand how people evaluate experiences. And that's what we'll be talking about for the remainder of this lecture. We'll be reviewing some of the key rules for optimizing customer experience. In fact, we can put these rules together in our marketing toolbox as a tool for managing customer experience. But first, Let's take a step back and talk about what experiences are and about how they're evaluated. Think about a recent experience you've had. Take your last vacation. That vacation was made up of thousands of individual moments in time. And at each point, you were feeling something. Happy or sad, excited or exhausted, frustrated or elated. But when you got home, your friends asked you how your vacation was, and you were somehow able to deliver a single aggregate response that covered the entire trip. It was great, or it was okay. How did you do that? How did you aggregate all those moment-by-moment responses into a single overall evaluation? You might think you just averaged all those experiences to come up with a kind of mean experience score, and this became your overall evaluation. That's a pretty good guess, but it's wrong. It turns out the researchers who have studied this have determined that when we evaluate an experience, whether it's a phone call with customer service, or a dinner at a restaurant, or a trip to Disney World, there are two points in time that overwhelmingly determine how we evaluate the entire experience. One point that turns out to really matter a lot is the peak. That is, the best, most enjoyable part of a good experience, or the worst, least enjoyable part of a bad experience. So maybe, over the course of your week-long vacation, there was one point in that experience that was especially good. Maybe the dinner you had one night where the food was great and your spouse was happy and the kids were laughing and having fun and you just took your first bite of that amazing dessert that they had just brought to the table. That was the best moment of the whole trip for you. Well, it turns out that just how good that best moment made you feel, that's going to be really important in determining how you feel about the trip as a whole. The other point in time that really matters is the end of the experience. What you were feeling right as the experience came to a close. So, how did you feel in the moments leading up to the end of what you considered to be your vacation experience? Was checking out of the hotel a real hassle? Were there unexpected complications right before you left for the airport? When people look back at an experience and rate how they felt about it, what psychologists call a retrospective evaluation, a simple average of the peak and the end predicts how people will rate the experience as a whole. This finding is so robust, it has come to be known as the peak-end rule. The peak-end rule leads to several specific bits of advice when it comes to managing customer experiences. The first is to finish well, or at least less bad. We'll put that in our toolbox as the first rule for managing customer experiences. Finish as well as you can. As one of the two points in time that matter the most, you want to make sure that the end is great. Or, if you can anticipate that it will be an unpleasant experience for your customer, say, a call from your customer service center to report a problem, for example, do what you can to make sure the end of the experience is as good as you can reasonably make it. I have a professor friend who jokes that ever since he learned about the peak-end rule, whenever he yells at his kids, he makes sure that when he's done with his rebuke, when he's sure that he has gotten his message across, he'll continue to yell at his kids for another minute, just not quite as loudly or as angrily. That way, when his kids remember the experience of being yelled at, it won't seem quite so bad. So the end of an experience matters. Make it as pleasant as possible. A related bit of advice is to get bad experiences out of the way early. This is rule number two. Get bad experiences out of the way. If there's any part of the interaction with the customer you know will be unpleasant, getting it out of the way early reduces the likelihood that the worst part of the experience will come at the end. If the worst part comes at the end, that's a double whammy. That is especially bad. So make sure bad experiences come with enough time that you can improve things before the experience ends. For example, Many businesses acquire their business by pitching their services to prospective clients. And many of these sales pitch meetings proceed in the same way. The team explains all the benefits of the service up front, and then they end the meeting by revealing the price tag. But think about this from a customer experience standpoint. You are communicating most of the feel-good information up front, and the price, which is usually the client's least favorite part of the meeting, is saved for the end. The peak-end rule suggests that clients may remember the experience of the pitch meeting more favorably if the least pleasant part were to come earlier in the meeting. Finally, the peak-end rule gives us our third tool for managing customer experience. Focus on the peaks. If you're considering two different ways of improving your customer experience, one that will improve the average throughout the experience, and one that will make the best part just a little bit better. For example, imagine you're running a theme park. You find that you have the money allocated to spend on park improvements, and you can either make some changes that would improve the food at the concession stands by a little bit, bringing them from okay to pretty good food, or you could spend that money to make your most popular roller coaster just a little bit more intense. Well, the peak-end rule suggests that the first scheme will be a waste of time and effort. Improving the peak, the most intense part of the experience, is more likely to deliver an overall improvement in customer experience than improving the average. The fourth rule of customer experience is to consider the reference points. Remember that experiences are often evaluated relative to some reference point, some expectation of how the experience should go. So exactly the same interaction with a firm could be evaluated as excellent by a customer who is not expecting things to go well, but as terrible by someone who is expecting something truly spectacular. That customers rely on reference points when evaluating experiences shouldn't be surprising. People use reference points when evaluating stimuli of all kinds. If you were to evaluate how bright the lights are in your building's lobby, your evaluation would be heavily influenced by whether you had just come in from the bright and sunny outdoors or whether you had just come in from a dark theater. The same is true with evaluating experiences. Your evaluations are strongly influenced by your reference point. Your job as a marketer is to determine what reference points your customers have when evaluating your experience, and if possible, to influence your customers' judgments by providing them with reference points. One reference point that marketers can control is the one established by their company's own communications. If advertising and social media campaigns and public relations messaging all paint a picture of a magical customer experience, customers will take note and they will set their expectations accordingly. Sometimes marketers forget that there can be consequences for failing to deliver on promises, so long as they get customers through the door that first time. But if you are promising customers a fantastic experience in your communications, you'd better be sure you're delivering, because you are setting the expectation that service will be fantastic. And then, even very good service could be evaluated as a failure. Customers differ in terms of the expectations they bring to market transactions. One way of tackling this tricky question of what are my customers' reference points for evaluating products and services is to treat it as a segmentation and targeting problem. Different customers have different expectations, but what do your customers tend to expect? Are the customers you are seeking to serve especially discerning? Are they well-informed? Do they have deep experience in this category? Have they been using services like this for a long time? Well, if yes, then your customers are likely to have high expectations, and you should plan accordingly if you want to provide a great customer experience. Another place to look for help in figuring out what your customers may be using as reference points is the category in which you're competing. Customers tend to evaluate experiences relative to the environment in which they find themselves. Some categories have a reputation for high product quality or high levels of service, and customers will tend to expect more. So, if you were going to get a massage, you probably are expecting some high level of professionalism and service, and it may take especially great service for you to take notice and evaluate it as great. Your expectations for service when getting your driver's license renewed are likely to be very different. I'm wowed by the great service anytime a DMV employee isn't openly hostile towards me. So use that. Recognize that the level of service your customers are likely to get is based in part on the category in which you are competing. A final bit of advice on using customer reference points to anticipate customer experience. These reference points reset. People tend to acclimate to what we have previously experienced. In fact, people acclimate surprisingly quickly. What was miraculous yesterday becomes the minimum standard today. Psychologists call this the hedonic treadmill. When we, as human beings, receive a wonderful surprise or a horrible shock, something that we anticipate will make us much happier or sadder for a long time, possibly forever, well, despite our expectations, over time we tend to return to our baseline level of happiness. Psychologists have found that things like getting a raise, falling in love, getting a divorce, winning the lottery, even losing a limb or the death of a loved one, most people recover from these things, good or bad, and return to the same general level of happiness they had before the big event. Often, it's as soon as just a few months later. People adjust to their new realities quickly. The comedian Louis C.K. encapsulated this wisdom brilliantly. He noted that even though, compared to the entire history of human civilization, things are now objectively amazing, nobody seems happy about it. For example, we complain when we're flying somewhere and we have to wait on the tarmac. We complain as if it is some great injustice that we had to wait for 40 minutes before takeoff. You had to wait for 40 minutes? Really? Oh, that's terrible. What happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly, like a bird? Did you take part in the miracle of human flight? It's amazing. You're sitting there in a chair in the sky. You're like a Greek myth right now. Yeah, but the chair doesn't move all the way back. People get used to experiences quickly. This can work against you. It can mean that what really impressed your customers in the past is now what they come to expect as commonplace. There are companies that find themselves trapped in increasingly frantic scrambles to innovate and to keep ahead of customer expectations, precisely because customers adjust so quickly and update their expectations. But the resetting of reference points can also work to your advantage if you play it right. This leads us to our next rule for managing customer experience. Segment pleasures and combine pain. Imagine two men, Mr. A and Mr. B. Mr. A wins a raffle for $50. Then later that same day, he wins another raffle for an additional $25. Mr. B wins a single raffle for $75. Who is happier? Objectively, they should be equally happy. After all, both are up $75 on the day. But when Richard Thaler, an economist at the University of Chicago, who developed these hypotheticals, asked people, he found that people overwhelmingly thought that Mr. A would be happier. Now let's try the reverse. Mr. A gets a $50 parking ticket. Then later that same day, he gets another parking ticket for an additional $25. Mr. B gets a single ticket for $75. Who is more unhappy? Again, most people say Mr. A. That poor sucker who got two parking tickets in one day will be more upset than Mr. B, the guy who only got one ticket for the same amount. What is going on here? Why are people happier to have two good experiences and more upset to have two bad experiences? Well, there's a two-part answer to that question. The first part is that people tend to evaluate discrete experiences individually. So if you win a raffle, and then some time passes, and you win another raffle, you feel as though two discrete positive experiences have happened to you. And people reset their expectations for each new experience. This is the hedonic treadmill in action. Each new experience tends to be evaluated on its own. The second part of the answer is something called diminishing sensitivity. People tend to be more sensitive to changes that happen close to a reference point than that happen farther away from the reference point. That sounds complicated, but you've experienced this lots of times. Diminishing sensitivity is the reason you are very sensitive to a 10-cent price difference in two cans of tuna that each cost about a dollar, but relatively insensitive to a $600 difference between two cars that each cost about $40,000. Diminishing sensitivity is the reason why winning $20 feels so much better than winning $10, but winning $120 feels only a little bit better than winning $110. We get less sensitive to changes on the margins, the larger the absolute amounts we're talking about. Think about how thrilled you would be if you won a $15 million lotto. Now, would you really be twice as happy if you won a $30 million lotto instead? Probably not. That's diminishing sensitivity. So, let's tie these two reasons together. When Mr. A won the first raffle, he would have felt good regardless of the amount. And the more he wins, the less each extra dollar increases his happiness. But then that experience is reset, and his expectations reset along with it. And then he wins again, and he gets to feel that great sense of winning all over again. Mr. B, on the other hand, he only gets to experience that sense of winning just the one time. He gets the full $75, but remember that those dollars, when won all at once, feel less great than winning twice, once for 50 and once for 25. This leads us back to the advice for managing customer experiences. Segment pleasures and combine pains. When designing products and services, seek out opportunities to let your customers feel as many discrete, happy experiences as you can. So, is there a way for customers to experience the benefits of a product one at a time in discrete episodes that is better than giving them everything at once? Can your salespeople introduce each benefit of the equipment you're selling one at a time with a demonstration of each benefit, allowing people to absorb that information? Separate it out into discrete experiences. Can you design the web tutorial of your software so that the beneficial functions are revealed piecemeal as a series of pleasant surprises to your customer? The opposite advice holds for bad experiences. Combine pains. If you need to call a customer to tell them that something went wrong, that something's been delayed or recalled or is malfunctioning, for heaven's sake, make sure you are certain of all the possible bad news you have to share before you make the call. The worst thing to do is to dribble out bad news over time. Each new disappointment will be felt as a fresh injury. It's like getting multiple parking tickets instead of just one for the full amount. Bad news will always be painful, but it's much better to get it all at once than to suffer death by a thousand cuts. The sixth and last rule for managing customer experiences is to motivate and empower those employees who will actually interact with your customers. On the incentives front, make sure that employees are evaluated on and rewarded for providing good customer experiences. This may mean developing employee evaluation tools that incorporate customer feedback as a metric. It may also mean tracking, praising, and publishing internally examples of great customer service. Make providing great customer experiences a source of prestige within the organization. It's important to remember that incentives come in more forms than just dollars and cents. Southwest Airlines, for example, incentivizes good behavior from its employees in the form of freedom and respect. Its wisecracking flight attendants are given that freedom and even encouraged to express themselves as they interact with customers. Management has demonstrated that they trust the employees to use good judgment in choosing how to interact with customers, and the customer experience is generally improved as a result. Richard Branson, founder of the Virgin Empire, put it well. He said, "If you take care of your employees will take care of your customers, and your customers will take care of your shareholders." Once that culture of customer service is established, employees can internalize that motivation. It can become an intrinsic part of how your employees interact with customers all the time. The Four Seasons is well known for its impeccable customer service. The company has incentivized employees to provide great customer experiences through a profit-sharing program, more breaks, and higher pay than competitors. These extrinsic motivators have led to an intrinsic motivation to create great customer experiences. In one astounding example, a longtime bellhop at the Four Seasons in New York discovered that a visiting dignitary had left behind a briefcase after checking out. This employee felt responsible for not having safely seen all of the guests' luggage into the departing limousine, so he purchased a ticket on his own dime and personally flew the briefcase down to Washington, D.C. to hand deliver it to the customer. I like to picture him sitting in his bellhop uniform in the plane the whole ride down. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground here. Let me briefly summarize the 6 rules for managing customer experiences. The end of an experience matters. Make it as pleasant as possible. Get bad experiences out of the way. Focus on the peaks, improve the best part, and make the worst parts less bad. Remember the reference points. Segment pleasures and combine pains. And finally, motivate and empower your employees. That gives you an approach for creating products and services that lead to great customer experiences. In subsequent lectures, we will discuss how to use some of the other tactics in the marketing mix to implement your marketing strategy.
This lecture is titled, The Tactics of Successful Branding.
I once had an eager young MBA student ask to meet with me. He had an idea for an entrepreneurial venture, and he wanted some marketing advice. This isn't too uncommon for marketing teachers, and I was happy to help him work through some of his ideas. He wanted to start a clothing line. He and his buddies had been working on this idea on and off for several years, and they thought they were ready to launch. He told me a little bit about the products they would be selling, the manufacturing and the distribution they had planned, but where he really came alive was in describing the branding. He had a very clear idea about what the logo would look like, the color scheme they would use. They had a tagline that would be incorporated into their advertising. He had clearly given this a lot of thought. And what he wanted to know from me was, would this be a good brand for their new line of clothes? To which I, academic that I am, responded, "I don't know." I wasn't trying to be cheeky. Well, maybe a little. But the fact is, by telling me everything he was picturing about his brand, he had not given me enough information to pass any kind of judgment, because he hadn't yet told me who his target customers were and what they valued. And when I started to ask him about whom he would be selling to, it quickly became apparent that those plans were not nearly as detailed. This is the first thing to remember about branding. Branding is a tactic, an important tactic to be sure, but just a tactic. And as such, decisions about branding should only be attempted after you have your strategy in place. In other words, you should not try to settle any aspect of your brand until after you know who your customer is and what they value and how you plan to position your offering so it will provide superior value relative to your competitors. Only after you know those things can you hope to make sensible decisions about your brand. Okay? Okay. I guess now would be a good time to take a step back and define what a brand is and what a brand does. There are a couple of ways to think about a brand. One definition is practical. It focuses on branding elements associated with a particular product or line of products. Branding elements include things like the name, logo, slogan or tagline, sometimes a character, maybe a spokesperson, even things like the font and color scheme, packaging design, endorsements, sponsorships. It can also include more abstract things like a design aesthetic or guiding philosophy. This definition of a brand is from the company's perspective. Many companies have detailed sets of rules about what can and can't be done with branding elements, including acceptable color schemes and acceptable modifications that may be made to logos. This is a really useful way of defining a brand, and every company should know internally what elements are part of its brand. But this internally focused definition of a brand is not sufficient. One must also consider what a brand is from the customer's perspectives. What are brands to customers? There are many possible definitions, but the one I favor is brands as cognitive structures in memory. According to this view, a brand is the network of feelings, information, thoughts, experiences, and evaluations associated with a particular product, service, or company as stored in a customer's memory. What do you think of and what do you feel when I mention Ford or Coke or Whole Foods? Those thoughts and feelings? That's the brand from the customer's point of view. According to this definition of branding, brands have layers. The memory nodes closer to the center of the memory structure are those that are more tightly bound with the brand. Those farther out on the edges are memories that are less integral, more transient and fleeting. So, for the brand Nike, there are some memories that have been reinforced over time and are so very close to the center of this memory structure. Things like the Nike swoosh and the tagline, "Just do it." You might also have memories of specific sports or sports figures, or even just the idea of sportiness. For me, Michael Jordan is tightly bound with the Nike brand. For younger customers, it might be a different athlete entirely. You would also have memories that are less distinct, farther removed from the center of this bundle. These might include times that you've worn Nikes yourself, or times that you've seen them worn by others. Maybe Nike ads you've encountered, even news reports about Nike's labor practices, and so on. This definition of a brand makes it clear that managing a brand is really about managing the associations customers store in memory related to that brand. This goes beyond just choosing a clever tagline. It means being consistent and reinforcing important ideas over and over again, forging and reforging those links in memory. To illustrate this, let me give you an example of what not to do. Think of the office supply brand Staples. What comes to mind for you? What nodes are tightly bound to your memory structure for the Staples brand? I can tell you that one idea Staples would like to have associated with their brand is low prices. Over the past several years, they've been running ads emphasizing their low prices. One series of ads features a man wandering through the aisles at Staples, examining one item after another. After he looks at each item on the shelf, he points at the price tag and says, "Wow, that's a low price! Wow, that's a low price!" The message is pretty clear. Staples has low prices. In fact, the closing shot of the ad expresses that idea mathematically. It says, "Staples equals low prices." Pretty compelling. You can't fight math. So how successful has Staples been in getting that message across? Well, think of the associations you have with the Staples brand. When I ask my MBA students what comes to mind when they think of Staples, many of them mention the easy button. This was a long-running ad campaign emphasizing that Staples was the place to go to quickly and painlessly solve your office supply problems. This is a perfectly fine way for Staples to position themselves. It's a simple message that provides a distinct source of value to a particular group of customers. If you think back to the lecture on positioning, I would argue the Staples Easy Button campaign did a lot of things right. On the other hand, when I ask my students about their associations with the Staples brand, no one mentions low prices. The problem arises when Staples tries to position on being easy, which suggests a high level of service and convenience, and also on having low prices. These ideas are in conflict for most people. So to the extent that Staples was successful in establishing a node in memory linking Staples to easy, they were also likely inhibiting the links between Staples and low prices. By the same token, if Staples eventually is successful in establishing a memory structure linking Staples to low prices, they may do so at the expense of the easy message. Some links in memory inhibit others. Let's look at another decision Staples has made on managing their brand. One of the most prominent things Staples has done to promote their brand is to sponsor the Staples Center. This is the basketball arena where the Los Angeles Lakers play. Was this a good decision? Well, it certainly gets their brand a lot of attention. If the goal were simply to increase top-of-mind awareness, then sponsoring the arena seems like a good idea. But how well does it fit with the associations they want people to form with their brand? By sponsoring the arena where the Los Angeles Lakers play, Staples is creating a link between their brand and the team, a link that is reinforced every time a customer watches a game or sees a SportsCenter highlight reel. And what associations do people have with the Lakers? Glitz, glamour. Hollywood celebrities attend those games. The players are all known for driving expensive cars and wearing expensive fashionable suits and living in huge mansions. All of these associations come to be linked in memory with the Staples brand. This is not inherently a bad thing, but it is inconsistent with the low price message. That is the first big lesson of branding. Be consistent. You are trying to manage a cluster of associations in your customer's memory. That requires consistency and discipline. Some actions that could serve another marketing goal, like increasing visibility or increasing sales, might be bad from a branding perspective. You should always ask yourself, what associations are you encouraging your customers to form with your brand? The second big lesson of branding is that when you encourage customers to form an association with your brand, make sure that association is, in fact, something they value. This may seem obvious, but sometimes firms just assume they know what creates value for their target customer without really doing sufficient research to make sure. Consider the example of Nescafe. Nescafe was the very first instant coffee. This innovative new product meant that if you wanted a cup of joe, you no longer needed to brew up an entire pot. Instead, you could just dump a spoonful of freeze-dried crystals into the mug, pour in some hot water, and bam, instant caffeinated goodness. Nescafe's target customers were housewives. That was the preferred term in the 1940s. And the benefits they offered these women was as a way for them to take a break and to treat themselves. Take a few minutes from all your hard work as a wife and mother and relax with a delicious cup of coffee conveniently prepared in just a few minutes. One of the print ads that they ran at that time featured a woman sitting at her kitchen table in a house dress and with her hair done up in a kerchief. She clearly looks like she's taking a break of some kind from housework, and she's sipping a cup of coffee and reading the newspaper. This seemed like a great association to make in the minds of consumers. Who could argue that these hard-working women deserved a break? Nescafe is an escape, a treat, a way to relax. And who could object to that? Well, one group that apparently objected to that was the housewives themselves. Women in that target market at that time had a lot of self-worth tied up in the effort they put into taking care of their homes and their families. And they didn't want to associate themselves with a brand that they associated with slacking off. To our modern ears, this sounds just crazy. But if it sounds crazy to you, it's just another case of you not being the customer. To give you some idea of how well Nescafe associated the idea of relaxation with their brand and how badly that played out with their target customers, let's look at some market research published way back in 1950. In this study, women, housewives, were shown one of two shopping lists, and they were asked to form an opinion about the woman who had written that list. The lists were almost identical. They included hamburger, carrots, Wonder Bread, Del Monte peaches. The only difference was that one list included Maxwell House drip coffee, and the other included Nescafe instant coffee. That was it. That was the only difference. On the basis of just the shopping list, participants were asked to describe this hypothetical woman in their own words. Almost half of the study participants described the Nescafe shopper as lazy. 48% called her lazy based on nothing more than the fact that she bought instant coffee from Nescafe. Relative to the Maxwell House shopper, respondents were also more likely to call the Nescafe shopper a poor planner. Spendthrift. 16% even called her a bad wife. Nescafe was successful in creating the mental associations it had set out to create. Unfortunately, those were not the associations that appealed to its target customer. Now that we've defined what brands are and a little bit about how to manage them, let's talk about how brands create value for customers. I'll frame this discussion around the same four sources of value that I mentioned in our very first lecture. These are functional value, monetary value, social value, and psychological value. Brands can provide or reinforce or augment each of these sources.